Good morning, Portland, Maine, all around Maine, and our online global audience. You're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O. WLOB 1310 AM, 100.5 FM, and also this show and other shows at TideSmartRadio.com. How are we doing, Deb?
Very good. How about you?
I am in a state of shock and awe.
Are you?
To quote somebody from
past
political role. Yeah, shock and awe. But before we get too deep, a couple of days ago, in fact, within hours of this last election taking place, I was lucky enough to get former three-time governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis, on the phone.
Yes.
And I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, but in the 80s, I grew up in Boston in the 60s and 70s, but in the 80s, I was working on a project, and I had a chance to work with the former governor, and he was also the Democratic nominee in 1988.
Yes.
And why don't we go to the interview? Because it was literally within hours of the election being finalized on Wednesday morning at around 3 or 4 a.m. I think the election was called, and I think around 9 a.m., Michael Dukakis and I were on the phone talking about it.
Very good.
Because, of course, when a big political election story comes out, a political giant like Mike Dukakis wants to get Steve-O on the phone.
Well, of course.
So that makes perfect sense. So let's play that interview, and then we will come back right after that to talk about if the world is going to be coming to an end or not.
Okay.
Here is my interview with former governor of Massachusetts, Mike Dukakis, and former Democratic presidential nominee. Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM and 100.5. Please join me for our very, very special guest, Mike Dukakis, former three-time governor in Massachusetts and Democratic presidential candidate in 1988. Thank you for joining us this morning, Governor.
Happy to do it, even though I'm a little sleepy after last night.
I was up till 3:30, and it's both sleep deprivation and there's a profound sense of sadness and concern that I want to get to. But I also want to reintroduce myself to you, Governor. In 1985, a young Steve-O was working in Boston. And I was working with a group called SAD, Students Against Driving Drunk, which was an initiative that you supported. And I spent some time working with you and your administration with the Coca-Cola company. And I have a picture of you and I standing there at one of these events. And so I have been a supporter of yours, both in terms of I grew up in Needham, Mass., in terms of your work in Massachusetts, and also your role on the national stage and you being the Democratic nominee of 1988. So I'm very, very proud to have you on the show today.
Well, thanks. And thanks also for what you were doing in the mid-1980s. As you know, our work on SAD served as the basis for the creation of something we call the Governor's Alliance Against Drugs and Alcohol, which at least the DEA said was the best such program in the country. And really had a profound impact on drinking and drugging, especially among young people in Massachusetts. Unfortunately, my successors really didn't commit to it, and it didn't have anywhere near the kind of impact that it should have had after I left office. But at a time when we're now facing another drug problem,
right?
And as anyone knows, you can't fight this stuff a drug at a time, because folks with addictive problems will use anything if it's available.
Yeah,
or if their favorite one is not available.
Right.
And I hope one of these days somebody comes along and says, hey, could you take that Governor's Alliance Against Drugs and Alcohol and dust it off and let us go to work on it? Because, you know, if all we do is try to stop or reduce opioid use without dealing with the entire problem with a heavy emphasis on prevention and treatment, we're going to fail. And as you've probably seen, the numbers are going up and up and up, notwithstanding the efforts that are being made. And the reason for that is that it's not a comprehensive program. It doesn't include education and prevention and treatment. And
I actually attended a TED Talk last week, and Governor, it's almost like you read my column this week, and I wrote a column referencing the presentation where the Portland, Maine chief of police, Chief Susnick, spoke about his evolution. He used to be a DEA enforcement officer, and he claimed from the stage of this TED Talks that the war on drugs was a failed effort, and now he's evolved in his thinking in law enforcement where it really, as you just mentioned, needs to recognize that with substance abuse, there are so many interconnecting issues involving mental illness, family, socioeconomic issues, where we need to create a more holistic approach to helping people as opposed to using the criminal justice system to try to remedy something that is a chemical and behavioral and societal problem, right?
And now, thanks to the Affordable Care Act, which we will see, will it survive Trump? He says no. But thanks to the Affordable Care Act, for the first time, virtually everybody in the United States has access to treatment for addiction. And who of us does not have somebody in their family circle or circle of friends that doesn't have that problem? So despite Trump's victory, and maybe because of Trump's victory, if he's smart about this thing, we'll stop talking about attacking opioids or methamphetamine or this substance or that substance, and we'll get serious about a real program of education and prevention and treatment beginning in the early elementary grades, which is where it has to begin. We were very successful at it. I think we were a pretty good model for how to do it. And Students Against Driving Drunk, with which you associated, was where we started. So thanks for being part of that.
Well, thank you. We have former Governor Mike Dukakis from Massachusetts, three-term governor and also Democratic nominee in 1988. We're taping this show on Wednesday morning, and we're literally 6 or 7 hours away from the kind of the conclusive news that Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States. This show will air in a couple of days. I know that from reading various clippings that you had supported Hillary Clinton, and you were also a vocal critic on Mr. Trump, talking about his draft dodging and how he trashed John McCain, which I agree was just egregious. And talk a little bit about how things have shifted in the U.S., where when you ran for president in 1988, something at the time which I thought was insignificant, whether it was the kind of the photo optics of you in the tank, which was widely criticized unfairly, or Howard Dean at one point having an outburst during his campaign, or Joe Biden plagiarizing a sentence, how those things in the past were seen as reasonable triggers to derail somebody in a presidential sense. But we just went through a year where thousands of individual crimes and misdemeanors, and I'm speaking literally, from treating women, comments, things said about our military, immigration policy, insensitivity to a handicapped journalist. It goes on and on, and somehow we've become dulled or desensitized to those things, where it was just a few years ago where one little optic all of a sudden created this sense of, well, that person may not, shouldn't be president. How do we get to this place?
Well, it's always been out there, as you point out. Whether it was, I don't think the thing in the tank was the real problem. I was attacked allegedly for being soft on crime because, like 45 other states, we had a furlough program, which, by the way, was created by my Republican predecessor, not me. And in point of fact, I tightened up quite substantially. But whether it was my situation or one of these others that you've mentioned, opponents will seize on that. And one of the big mistakes I made in 1988 was to decide, and it was my decision, nobody else's, that I would not respond to the Bush attack campaign, and that turned out to be a big, big mistake. But you know, if you've been in politics and government for 25 or 30 years, as many of us have, you're going to make all kinds of decisions. And it's not that difficult to try to pull one of those out and try to make it, your opponent's headline. It was just my mistake, frankly, in not being ready for that. In point of fact, the most liberal furlough program in America in 1988 was the furlough program in the Reagan-Bush federal prison system. But I never said that. And if you don't say that, don't be surprised if people start believing what you're hearing. And look, all you have to do is read the Hamilton biography. It's long, but I finally finished it. The back and forth between Hamilton and Jefferson was fierce,
right.
And the press at that time didn't even make a pretense of being objective and nonpartisan. They were fiercely partisan, and Hamilton, as we know, ended up getting killed by Aaron Burr on a field in New Jersey when he was 47 years of age with seven kids, the youngest of which was two. So the idea that, it's so much worse these days, and it was all kind of pristine and companionable back in those days,
right,
is nonsense. No question that this time around we had a lot more noise, but I think a lot of that had to do with, two things. First, Trump's history, and secondly, this email thing, which I thought was the biggest crock I had ever heard. I mean, look, I don't know if anybody in Washington doesn't have a private email and doesn't use it. And in some cases, the only way to get a hold of them. Colin Powell had one. Condoleezza Rice had one. I don't remember any criticism of them. And I think in this case, the press was really very, very gullible.
Well, I think it was gullible, but also, I mean, you have not only have a lengthy and respected political career, but you've recently been teaching at UCLA and Northeastern. Does the media play, should the media be held accountable because the economics of media have changed, the credibility of media, and they are incentivized to create false equivalencies, to create clicks and visits and I don't want to join the chorus of blame the media, because I personally think that the media failed us during this election, because Trump wasn't held accountable for many of the things he said or done, or the fact that he didn't release his taxes, or the list goes so long that I forget half the things he did. But the media seemed more focused on creating attention for the media coverage than really holding him as a candidate accountable.
Well, the media, a lot of us are going to have to do a lot of rethinking here and learning. I mean, well, the defeat is very painful, but done right, it can be a very good learning experience. And that's true of those of us on the political side, and it's true of folks in the media. Toward the end, I thought the media was finally starting to do what it's supposed to do as the public's representative, really. But for months and months, I mean, they essentially let this guy get away with murder. I mean, they found him entertaining, and it was kind of like reality television and that kind of thing. And it wasn't until finally you had some media conduct, which including the famous interview with Matt Lauer did with Trump and Hillary, where he kind of softballed Trump and spent half of Hillary's time talking about these foolish emails, that you began to get a reversal, but that was kind of late. So everybody's got to do some serious rethinking here. I think that's important. Otherwise, the lessons that we ought to learn from what happened will not be learned.
We've got former Governor Mike Dukakis from Massachusetts on the line. Talk about Brexit versus the Trump phenomena. Did we miss the canary in the coal mine when the UK had that vote that had a similar pattern, I believe, in terms of the vote coming out in favor of exiting the EU? Because you know, over there, it doesn't feel like the politicians and the pundits picked up on the deep-rooted unrest, kind of the anger towards the system. And do you think, how much of this do you believe is a psychology of voters and citizens and people feeling disenfranchised, just expressing frustration against a failed system as opposed to really truly believing Trump is the leader that we want?
Well, we shouldn't have been taken by surprise on that. And in point of fact, as you recall, when the Brexit vote took place, there were a lot of people in the United States, including press people, saying, hey, this is a sign of what may happen in the presidential campaign. And we heard a lot of that. It wasn't as if we were taken by surprise. Would there be potentially a Brexit-like vote which would support a guy like Trump and with the same conditions around? I think one of the reasons that while many of us heard that, we didn't take it quite as seriously is because, in point of fact, since Obama took over, this country has made great progress. We've come out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. We've added over 15 million new jobs. Working incomes of middle-class folks are finally starting to go up. I personally felt quite good about where the country
and all against a Congress that, you know, even before I think President Obama took office, Mitch McConnell and other Republicans said their mission in life or the mission
to make him a one-term president.
Yeah, and to me that almost seemed treasonous, where elected officials really should be there in purpose to serve all of the country, and to go into a new presidency saying our goal is to see this person fail, it felt at the time and now in retrospective as being treasonous against the interests of the country.
Well, but maybe we should have said that more often.
Right.
You know, I grew up, I was born in 1933. In fact, I think the banks were shut down by Roosevelt for, what was it, the famous bank holiday, I think the day I was born. And I remember both FDR and Harry Truman never missing an opportunity to whack Herbert Hoover and the Republicans for the Depression. In fact, it was a little unfair, because Hoover was not a bad guy. But they reminded people over and over and over again, this is what these folks did to you, and let's make sure it doesn't happen again. And if the truth be known, we Democrats ran against the Republicans on the Depression for about 40 years. Barack Obama inherited not a great depression, but a great recession. And one of the things you have to do is remind people of what he inherited. A very high unemployment, banks collapsing, hundreds of thousands of Americans losing their home.
The auto industry being derailed.
General Motors threatening to go into bankruptcy, and so on and so on and so forth. And I don't think we did a very good job of making sure that people remembered that. Because if you don't remind them, don't be surprised if over time they tend to forget it.
You're right.
And in addition, the reason we went into that recession, well, there were a lot of reasons, but one of them was terrible economic policies on the part of the second Bush administration, which featured tax cuts for the rich and the deregulation of financial institutions. Exactly the Trump platform. And I think we did a lousy job of reminding people that that's what got us into the Great Recession in 2007, 2008, and this guy is proposing exactly the same thing. And you've got to say this over and over again. It's not because people aren't smart. It's that, you know, they're living busy lives, and one of the ways that you try to influence them in the best way is to remind them over and over again of what happened in the past. Now, having said all of this, if I was such a genius, I'd have got myself elected president of the United States, too, and I didn't do that, and that was my fault. And I'm a big admirer of the current president, but I think all of us, he, Hillary, and all of us should have been reminding people over and over again, let's not go back to 2007, 2008, and let's not do it with a candidate who wants to do exactly the same thing that got us into that mess in the first place.
I agree. We have former Governor Mike Dukakis, three-term governor of Massachusetts. You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM. Governor, why don't we look forward on where we go from here? You're I believe, currently a distinguished professor of political science at Northeastern, visiting professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. After this election, and when he's sworn in January, the Republicans, in the form of Donald Trump, will have the presidency, a majority in the Senate, majority in the House, and with one open Supreme Court seat currently, with maybe one, two, or more in the next four-year term, for all intents and purposes, his appointee will push the Supreme Court to be more conservative, a majority of governors in the U.S. Given that climate, what is your thought in terms of where we're going as a country? And then part of that question is also, what does it mean for the rhetoric of when Donald Trump was campaigning and saying he was going to blow up the Obamacare, he was going to cut taxes, he was going to put up a wall? Under our political system with checks and balances, how likely are those dramatic things likely to happen, given that the Republicans have majorities of control? Or is there anything that you believe will be mitigated or changed where the world isn't going to come to an end in January when Donald Trump takes? Because right now everyone's on edge, you know, and it feels like, I don't want to say it's apocalyptic, but there will be a huge shift, both how we're seen on the global stage and because of global economies being more interconnected. You see that in the markets. But what should people look for going into next year when these majorities really take hold? And do you think it'll be as dramatic as some of the fears, or will government kind of check and balance itself and there'll be more moderate changes?
Well, let me say two things, one of which I've already said to some extent. The short answer is nobody can tell you. Trump is an interesting character. Obviously, I and millions of people were very unhappy with him and with what he was saying and the racism, the, you know, all of that stuff. The utter stupidity of spending $30 billion on a wall on the southern border of the United States, which is absolutely crazy. I mean, all that means is that the Mexican tunneling industry will be doing extremely well, you know? I mean, it's just ludicrous, especially at a time when net illegal immigration into the United States is zero. Zero right now. And this problem that he keeps talking about doesn't even exist. So this is going to have to evolve. I think for those of us, and there are millions that are unhappy with him and what he was saying and what he says he wants to do, our job is to be good Americans, to develop an approach which is willing to cooperate if, in point of fact, he and the people around him want to do that, but to also be a very vigorous opposition in the best sense of the word, and yet do so within a democratic framework. I mean, one of the things that just absolutely frosted me was the viciousness of his crowds, which he didn't seem to want to stop. The notion that Hillary Clinton was a criminal, which is just absolutely disgraceful, and totally without any basis. In fact, as we now know belatedly from the FBI director, and the stirring up of bitterness. Look, I've been in public life for a long time, and the reason I teach these days is because I want to encourage terrific young people who I'm fortunate enough to teach to go into public service themselves and to make really positive contributions to this country's future. And let me tell you, we're producing wonderful young people, and it's been my great privilege to be able to teach them for the last 25 years. I want these kids to feel good about the government that they're trying to get into and ultimately lead. I want them to feel good about running for office. I want them to have the opportunity that I've had in a remarkable way. And who was I? You know, this kid of Greek immigrants who thanks the American system, was able to achieve, I hope, a good deal and to serve in public office at very high levels. And I want these young people I'm teaching and I hope inspiring to have that same opportunity. So I think those of us who are unhappy with Trump and were very unhappy with his campaign now have an opportunity to try to help create a much more positive atmosphere. I think probably he'll try to do that now that he's won. But our job is to work with him cooperatively. Yeah. If in point of fact he embraces and supports the kinds of values which I think represent America at its best, but to be a very strong, loyal opposition if he starts coming in with some of this nonsense that he was talking about during the campaign. And so we've got a major responsibility ourselves. And, you know, I hope we'll carry it out.
I share your hope, and I don't know if it's a silver lining or just wishful thinking, but, you know, over the last 20 years, Donald Trump's position almost across the board has been, you know, it feels like anchored by kind of whimsy or opportunism, because at one point he's hugging Bill and Hillary Clinton and referencing her as a great U.S. senator or secretary of state, and a minute later, when it serves his own self-interest, he was attacking her viciously. And, you know, across the board, whether it's women's issues or whether it's immigration or Iraq or, you know, my hope is, and I don't know if this is a popular sentiment, is that, you know, this was on a grand stage an ego-driven exercise, and once that he's achieved this, that he will no longer need to use the vitriolic attacks and kind of the extremism, and maybe he'll just settle into, okay, what's the right thing to do here?
Well, let's hope so. I've got to leave you after this last comment, but I don't know that a lot of people know this, but he had very good things to say about Mike Dukakis in 1988. He said, well, this guy Bush is okay, but he said, I really like this guy Mike Dukakis. I like what he's doing in Massachusetts and so forth.
Well,
so maybe we can get back to the Donald Trump of that time. And I certainly hope so, because you know, I love this country. It's been wonderful to me and my family and my parents who came here as immigrants. And I want to see it continue to be a good country, a great country, a compassionate country. I've got 12 grandkids, all of whom I want to do great things for and with this country. And they're not going to be able to do it unless we have a strong, collaborative kind of effort here. So, you know, I'm more than willing, I hope many others are, to try to make a contribution to that, and I hope we can do so.
Well, thank you so much. And as I said, I grew up in Massachusetts. Thank you for your service as our governor for 3 terms and for what you're doing now in the academic world. And it's been an honor having you on the show. Thank you very much, former Governor Mike Dukakis.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay.
Great interview with former Governor Mike Dukakis. That was something, Deb, wasn't it?
That was amazing. He's awesome.
He is awesome. And the fact that literally 6 hours after the election was decided on Tuesday, he agreed to do a phone interview and catch up with his old buddy, Steve-O.
That's awesome.
Well, let's talk about the election.
Okay.
And this should be interesting because you and I come from different political perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
This has had, you know, you've had to be celebrating all week, and I'm sure Ray Richardson gave everyone the day off, and everyone's singing at the studio, and I know Ray was a big supporter of Donald Trump.
Yeah,
and
Ray was. I am a deplorable as well. I was a deplorable before he was.
Really? A self-described deplorable?
Self-described, yeah. Someone called me that once.
In what way are you deplorable? I've known you for years, and I would never, ever...
That was my question.
I would never describe you as...
Yeah.
I disagree with many of your views,
mm-hmm.
but you and I have always had a cordial, professional, respectful relationship, right?
Yeah, we have.
And we're going to continue that for 23 more minutes. We joked before going on the air that this could be contentious, and we double-checked the studio glass.
It seems to be holding up
to make sure that it was unbreakable. This election in its entirety, relative to the start of the campaigns and the contentiousness and divisiveness during the primaries to ultimately the result early Wednesday morning, was the most, in my experience, the most destructive political process that I've ever witnessed in my lifetime. And I think I echo the same feeling or express feeling from Hillary Clinton and for President Barack Obama the next day, when clearly they were disappointed, but their feeling was and is, now that the people have spoken and they have elected Donald Trump to be the next president, I think we have to give him a chance. I think that we, all of our interests are tied to the strength and the success of our leadership. So I have no impulse to say he's not my president or I don't respect the office of the president, which I think is different than four or eight years ago when the Republican Party, when Barack Obama was elected. I think Mitch McConnell basically said his one goal in life was to see if Barack Obama, all of his policies failed, which I, as I said to Mike Dukakis, I thought was treasonous. I don't know how a congressional leader would want his president to fail because of political differences. But I hope that Donald Trump proves many people wrong. I hope he enters the office with a level of seriousness and kind of somber duty relative to being the leader of the free world. But I am cautiously pessimistic.
Cautiously pessimistic. Wow.
Yeah, I'm cautiously. Yeah, I want him to succeed. My interest, my kids' interest, my grandkids, all tied to us having an effective government. And all, you know, the United States being respected around the world. Mm. But what's happened over the last year feels like that it'll be a difficult pivot for him to make.
Do you think we were or are respected around the world after the last 8 years of Obama?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
That's interesting.
In the last 8 years, I've traveled all over Asia, all over Singapore, Hong Kong, Macau, all over UK, England, Ireland, all over Spain, South America, Iceland, Canada, Mexico. And I think in the last 8 years, I've been to 12 or 14 different countries. So my perspective isn't reading blogs or it's not hearing kind of anecdotal. It's meeting with people, working with people. I'm part of a global organization of business leaders. We get together every 4 months. A few months ago, I was in Amsterdam and then Germany. So my perspective is working with 50 business leaders from around the world. And universally, what I've heard from meeting with people, doing business with people around the world, is there is respect for President Obama. He won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's considered a thoughtful leader. Michelle Obama is considered a very thoughtful first lady. And people may disagree with some of his policies, but he's respected around the world. When he goes to summits, other leaders generally have very warm, cordial interactions with him. The last year feels like Donald Trump has been in a contentious relationship with everyone, like everyone in his party during the primary. It was Lying Ted, Little Marco, Carly Fiorina looks funny. It was angry. It was hostile. It was disabled reporters being mocked. It was the issue with women. But his whole campaign for a year, bringing up Rosie O'Donnell a number of times, which was weirdly unnecessary.
The media brought up Rosie O'Donnell.
He brought up Rosie O'Donnell. Megyn Kelly, during the first debate, said, here are comments you've made. And he said, only about Rosie McDonald.
Forgive me for interrupting.
Sure.
But we could go on all day about what we've heard over the past 20 months of this campaign, right? We all know, we've all heard it, we've all been mortified, we've all been shocked, we've all been freaked out.
Well, 60 million people weren't that freaked out because they voted for him.
Because in the end, we want to know what you're going to do for us. That's what we want our president to tell us. What are you, if we elect you, what are you going to do? And I got on board because I saw a country that was going in a bad direction of socialism really, really fast.
In what way?
I'm being told that I have to have Obamacare or medical care. And if not, I'm going to be financially penalized for it. In a free society, that should not be happening.
In a free society,
it should be my choice.
But if you choose not to have health care and then you get sick or you have a heart attack,
Everybody gets sick.
Is it your choice for me to pay for it, or is it, you know, if you can?
That's an interesting question, because what if you have insurance and your insurance company decides that we're not going to pay for whatever procedure you need to have? Then you're still left out in the dark. The point is, it's a socialistic mindset there, and I don't like it. I am not afraid to say that I am a free American woman, and I'm proud to be that. I don't want to walk down a socialistic path. And 81,000 regulations were put into effect under this presidency. 81,000 new regulations.
I don't think that may be either a big number or a small number. In a government as complex as the U.S. federal government, A, I've never heard that statistic before, and B, there's no way to challenge it because, like many things that have come out of this campaign, giant numbers are thrown along. You know, scary things are proposed. 81,000. There could be 80,000 having to do with FCC regulations or EPA or DEP. There's no way to check if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, I happen to believe that more regulation is never a good thing. Anything with more rules and more regulations is bound to be stifled. Small business is having a hard time surviving in this country. You should know that.
My business is doing well. I started out with one person 13 years ago.
But you are not the only one. You know others who are having a hard time in this present environment.
I agree, but Deb, I look back 8 years. Do you remember 8 years ago?
Yes.
Right. Do you remember the unemployment rate? Do you remember the auto industry and GM facing bankruptcy? Do you remember Wall Street collapsing? So when you talk about today of people hurting, I think there's context. The world is more complicated. There are big things happening around the globe, not just in the U.S., things happening in the Middle East way beyond our control or way beyond our influence. And relative to the U.S., I don't know how any reasonable person could argue that we were better off 8 years ago than we are today.
No one is saying that. Who's saying that?
Then it's in the context of what President Obama has done for 8 years. He hasn't gotten one piece of credit. There's not one from any Republican or for Fox News. I haven't listened to one report.
Do you even listen to Fox News?
Yeah, you know what? I do. I flip back and forth.
I don't listen to it.
I watch all of them because I want to get different perspective. If you listen to Fox News, if you listen to Ray Richardson, who I respect his voice, I disagree with him adamantly on many things. I have never heard over the last 8 years any show or broadcast or story going, hey, we've got some great news today. President Obama has done this, or his fiscal policy looks like this happened, or unemployment rates are now lower than they've been in the last decade, or Cuba relationships are fundamentally a good thing. Every single thing our president, and he's still our president until January 20th, has done over the last eight-year period has been met with, it's bad, it's wrong, look what he's done. It is unfathomable. If you look at a snapshot of the country 8 years ago, and literally, our economy was going over the edge. And you look at where we are today, and then everyone seems to be on the conservative side, thinks it happened by accident. It happened, even though he was.
Why would you say that?
Because nobody has ever said, boy, President Obama did something great this week. Or President, it is every broadcast, every story, every perspective, every written word is the guy is bad, he's evil, he's this. And to have a candidate who's now the president-elect up until a month ago say that he wasn't even, you know, potentially a U.S. citizen, it was so divisive.
I like the policies that Trump wants to put forth. I don't like the fact that Hillary wanted open borders and to let everybody flood in. I don't think it's good for our economy.
The speech that she gave on open borders had to do a speech she made and had to do with energy open borders.
Yeah.
But when you take a sentence that says, I want open borders for energy.
I'm not just taking that. I'm also taking into consideration that she wants to expand the amount of refugees that come into the country. And the fact that our president is not stopping people coming into the border now and hasn't for over a year. He's telling our border agents to stand down. So let's all put two and two together. They want more people coming in.
What
they don't
that mean?
Want our borders.
What does that mean,
she
stand down?
She doesn't either.
But what does it mean, stand down? Do you think the people at the borders...
Why are you asking me these questions?
Do you think the people at the border are just sitting there and they're waving people in?
When you tell your officers to stand down, they are not to stop whatever's going on.
So your worldview is we have immigrants coming into the country right now, and they aren't being vetted, and they aren't going through extensive background, and that they were given orders by President Obama to stand down. And
one does not have to do with the other. The refugee situation does not have to do with the illegals coming in at the southern border.
But refugees have to come in somewhere. They still have to go through customs and immigration. They
don't necessarily come in through the southern border. They can come in through New York or wherever.
Right.
I'm not talking about the refugees in that aspect.
How about character?
Anyway,
do you think character?
Comey and whoever else said that we can't vet the refugees anyway.
I do not think the comment was we cannot vet the refugees. I think there's all kinds of levels. I think there are all kinds of levels that are applied.
Why would you want to take a chance?
Why? Because my grandparents were immigrants. Our country.
My grandparents were immigrants too.
There is no chance. It is in a democracy. There's inherent chances. The freedoms that we have open us up. And there are elements of our society that will be vulnerable. Bad things are going to happen. The idea of taking a chance is that there is a greater good for our society. Where do you stand on the character issue, Deb, since we're in a positive mood here? Do you think the character of our president means anything?
I have always believed that.
Okay.
And it came into play during Bill Clinton's presidency.
I agree with that. I think he exhibited.
And that's why I did not vote for Hillary, because her character was in question.
Because of emails or Benghazi or something like that?
Because of everything I've learned about her over the last 25 or 30 years that she's been around.
Okay. Do you think that Donald Trump has the character that should be or is acceptable to most Americans for the leader of our country?
I don't know if he has the character that's acceptable to most Americans, because I can't speak on behalf of most Americans. I will say this, that he has earned his own way in life, and that most people who know him have a very high opinion of him that I have learned about.
Okay. I would disagree with everything that you just said there. He was a wealthy son who at the time was a very wealthy real estate magnate. And whether he was loaned $1 million or $10 million, mm-hmm. I think is kind of in dispute. But he is not a guy. He's a guy that had 3 deferments from the draft. He got out of the military service. He didn't remember which leg was injured. And he was entitled. And so
a lot of people are entitled in the world and they still have high positions in life.
But this isn't high positions. This is the highest elected office. This is the person that controls not only our lives here, our children's, and because of cabinet appointments and because of all the federal offices and what's going on around the globe, he will, on January 20th, have power over billions of people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for somebody who has made the comments he's made, for somebody who set up Trump University, which was a scam, for somebody who's gone through 4 bankruptcies, to somebody who's recorded, you know, if Billy Bush lost his job because of inappropriate, disgusting comments. How is it that a month later, Donald Trump was elected president, where NBC decided, hey, Billy Bush, you got to go because you were disrespectful to women?
That was a farce. They knew they had the thing for years. They voted him in because they couldn't vote for Hillary Clinton.
Who couldn't vote for Hillary Clinton?
The American people. They could not let her win.
I don't think she was an ideal candidate. I'm not defending.
She was not.
I'm not defending. Sully, I think, has a comment here.
Well, the American people voted for her. She won the popular vote.
Yeah, but that's not how our system works.
I understand that, but if we're saying the people didn't want her, the individual people did.
If the people had wanted her, she would have gotten the electoral vote and she would have won. But she did not.
Okay. Speaking of character, do we have the American president clip here? I think it's the first one here.
We definitely do.
Okay. This is from the Aaron Sorkin movie, American President, and we'll talk about it.
And I want to know what it says to you that in the past 7 weeks, 59% of Americans have begun to question your patriotism.
Look, if people want to listen to
Patriotism, they don't have a choice. Bob Rumson is the only one doing the talking. People want leadership, Mr. President. In the absence of genuine leadership, they'll listen to anyone who steps up to the microphone. They want leadership. They're so thirsty for it, they'll crawl through the desert toward a mirage, and when they discover there's no water, they'll drink the sand.
Lewis, we have had presidents who were beloved, who couldn't find a coherent sentence with two hands and a flashlight. People don't drink the sand because they're thirsty. They drink the sand because they don't know the difference.
Yeah, they drink the sand. I hope President-elect Donald Trump is successful for my sake, your sake, your children, all of our children's sake. But I think what he represented to the American people was a mirage. It was sand. And I think he did come across as a dynamic leader primarily for a group of people that haven't had leadership. And what's happened with income inequality, what's happened with overall wages, and what's happened with the middle class disappearing, there have been major problems and mistakes over the last few decades that go deep in terms of our society and government leadership. But what Donald Trump promised over the last year, I think to that segment that we just listened to from the movie American President, was that people were thirsty for leadership and they thought they saw water. They thought when Donald Trump said, we're going to make America great, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. Sadly, many, many people, 60 million people, some portion of 60 million people were desperate for that. So I don't blame them.
You know, what's interesting when I hear this from you is that we were all made fun of because we were on the Trump train during the whole campaign. And now that he's won, we're being belittled once again for believing in a candidate. And I really hope that
after the end of
4 years, we'll see some good progress. We'll probably go through some pain first because there's a whole lot to do. But I hope we'll see some good progress. And I hope that people will stop trying to make us who voted for him and believed in him think that we're believing in sand or that we would drink sand instead of water and not know the difference.
Why? Why is that your specific hope?
I don't understand the question.
No, nobody belittled you or any of the other 60.
You just did. You compared us to somebody who does not know the difference between drinking sand or water.
What I said was the same people who signed up for Trump University.
That has nothing to do with the candidacy.
It is everything to do with it.
No, it is not.
It is the false promise. Sign up for Trump University.
It's a business that failed.
It is a scam.
There is no other business out there.
Donald Trump will teach you how to make millions. Give us your money. People gave up their savings.
That's nothing compared to marketing stuff that goes on like that.
You're right, but this isn't the sham wow rag. This is the presidency. That's the difference. Trump University was a scam. Atlantic City, the bankruptcies, the casino stuff.
Look,
those were scams.
Why do you mention bankruptcies? There are millions of people in this country that start businesses that fail and end up going to bankruptcy. Is that supposed to be something we're supposed to be shameful about? Or should we learn from it and go forward and do better?
Deb, we could do a four-hour show going through financial intricacies. This was not a guy who opened up a bagel shop who went out of business.
No.
He is a guy that took tax breaks, transferred equity of the—
As many businesses do in the form of TIFs.
It's not just that, Deb. He basically exploited the system, made hundreds of millions of dollars, and when somebody goes bankruptcy, it is not a benign event. Families that are owed the money lose the money. People that counted on him to pay bills were stiffed. Meanwhile, he took care of himself. All of it, the charity work, the Donald Trump Foundation. He put in like $60,000. He was using it to pay things off.
Foundations are set up like that. You put the seed money in the beginning, and then donors give you the rest of the money, Steve.
No, but that wasn't the—
Come on.
For a billionaire, he gave less money to charity than anyone in the history of the history of the world.
Oh, come on. You don't know that.
Of course I know that.
How do you know that?
Do you know it's not true?
How do you know that? You're the one that made the statement.
Returns. From his tax returns.
Well, how many tax returns have you seen?
None. Because you know why? That's a scam.
Why?
Because it was the accepted mechanism to understand the financial history and the health of presidential candidates. And for him to say, I'm in an audit, but I'll show it. He'll never show it.
It's irrelevant, and we did not care.
You're right. For many of his supporters, like you, you didn't care.
That's right.
My position is you should have. What he's doing with his company is irrelevant. Nobody else has run a campaign like him. Nobody else.
That's right.
Right. Nobody else has openly criticized the press and said the media are evil.
Yeah, but we haven't got enough time to go into that.
Well, let's end on a happy note. Deb, obviously you and I disagree. I think the one thing we agree with, which let's highlight this point, is I want President-elect Donald Trump to succeed, because if he succeeds as being a successful, effective president, it's good for our country and it's good for the world. So, with that,
I want more than that. I want him to succeed, but I want him to do the things that he said he did. And that's why we put him in, because we're tired of politicians that go into office telling us one thing, and then when they get there, they do nothing or they do the opposite.
How about we end on this note? 4 years from now, if the Great Wall of Trump is built, which he promised thousands of times, campaign,
yes, he did.
I will promise to fly you on an all-expense-paid trip to the Mexican border. Seriously.
To check it out?
Seriously. Well, to check out the Great Trump Wall. But if there is no wall, you will send me on a trip to Hawaii, all-expense-paid.
Ooh.
I don't know
if they can build it in 4 years.
Trump said he does great things very quick.
That's true.
Trump is very quick.
That's
He's very,
true.
Very super
That's
quick.
True.
Great, great. It's going to be huge.
Okay.
So do we have an agreement?
Okay, but I can only afford to send you to Hawaii. I can't afford your whole family.
Okay. Well, then we agreed on a happy note. Well, let's end there. To our audience, I don't even know what to say after this week. I feel like I am so fatigued.
We're all fatigued, that's for sure.
Well, you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m., 100.5. Unless the FCC is blown up between now and next Saturday, which could be the case, we will be back. Thank you for listening.